Good day, and welcome to today's conference. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone telephone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Please note this conference may be recorded. I will be standing by if you should need any assistance, and it's now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ms. Sylvie Légère. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. I'm Sylvie Légère. I'm the co-founder of the Policy Circle, and I'm really excited. This is our first launch of a policy brief. We have close to 100 Policy Circle leaders, members, and supporters on the call. And the briefs are really the heart of the Policy Circle meetings. There are now about 23 briefs in our Policy Circle year of conversation. And the theme for this month is in and outs of economics. So today we're launching the brief on entitlements because Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, and food stamps make up 60% of the federal budget. So it really impacts our economy. I have with me Kristen Jackson, who's a policy editor for the Policy Circle, and she wrote the brief, and Andrew Biggs, who is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies Social Security reform. Brian Riedel is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and he's focusing on budget, tax, and economic policy. And what we'll do is we'll start with remarks from Kristen, then Brian and Andrew, and then we will open the line for questions. But at any time, I think what Tony said is you can press one and then just kind of put your name in the queue for questions. So the call is 30 minutes, so this will be brief. And with that, I'm super thrilled to introduce Kristen Jackson. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. These briefs are really designed to be an opening conversation for a roundtable discussion. Really is an opportunity to pause and then go beyond the headlines. So I curate the briefs to provide Policy Circle members with that 360-degree view of an issue, which then provides you with the tools to go deeper in your understanding of touchy and complex topics such as entitlement programs. So when you come prepared to a Policy Circle meeting, you have the lens to understand the headlines and then have a rich conversation about it. So when it comes to entitlements, you might not realize it, but it really is all around you. It's in the news today, whether it's the latest budget fight or overhauling the food stamp program, which you may have seen news about over the weekend. It affects everything. It even comes up and it comes into play when thinking about immigration. No matter your position on immigration, an additional legal immigrant in our country adds to the number of entitlement benefits paid out. However, we're really not confronting entitlement spending as a nation. So in order to put these broad topics into context, the brief provides a historical perspective and the intent behind the programs as they were first designed. It also briefly provides the basics of what these programs do, and then it gets into the growing importance of the budgetary constraints on our country. Entitlements are really the elephant in the room anytime you hear about budget constraints. So these are very meaty topics, which makes me thankful for the two well-known experts who took the time to review the brief before it was published and have also joined our call today. Let's start with Brian from the Manhattan Institute. Brian Riedel is a passionate numbers person who knows the ins and outs of the trends and the forecasts of what these programs mean to our country. Brian, if you could take just 2 minutes to share with us the key data that people should know about entitlements and the budget.
Sure. Thank you very much. So I mainly look at Social Security and Medicare, which are the main drivers of our long-term fiscal problem. There's really two issues that are making these programs unsustainable. First is demographics. We have 74 million baby boomers who are going to retire and start collecting Social Security and Medicare benefits. And when you pay into these systems, your money doesn't get saved for you. It pays current beneficiaries. So the system works as long as you have enough taxpayers. Well, we had five workers paying the taxes of each retiree in the 60s. Now it's 3-to-1, and it'll be 2-to-1 in about a decade. So you have 74 million people requiring benefits. You also have a system where, for instance, in Medicare, the average retiring couple will get back triple what they paid into the system. So when you have 74 million people paying into a system and everyone getting back triple what they paid in Medicare and a little bit more than what they paid in Social Security, the costs explode. So here are the numbers, the key numbers. Over the next 30 years, the Social Security and Medicare system are going to run an $82 trillion deficit. Let me repeat, an $82 trillion deficit. Those numbers are staggering. The entire national debt right now is $20 trillion, but these programs themselves are going to run an $82 trillion deficit. The rest of the budget over the next 30 years is basically balanced. Outside of Social Security and Medicare, we're approximately balanced permanently. So really, this $82 trillion gap is the whole ballgame. And I'll throw one other number at you before I turn it over to the next speaker. If we were to just to raise payroll taxes to pay for this and to close the gap, you would have to raise payroll taxes to the current equivalent of $30,000 per household. That's adjusted for inflation and adjusted for income. So it would feel like today each family having a $30,000 payroll tax just to pay the benefits that are currently promised. So the key numbers, as I leave you, are 2-to-1, which is the ratio of workers paying for retirees in about 15 years, $82 trillion, which is the 30-year deficit for these programs, and $30,000 per household, which is the payroll tax that would be necessary to pay for all of this. That's my happy report.
Thanks, Brian. Now turning to Andrew from AEI. My experience working with Andrew Biggs has been as an innovative thinker, someone who can look at these same issues from different angles and continue to propose new solutions. Andrew, from your research, what is the top point that people should have in mind when engaging in a dialogue on entitlement reform in the U.S.?
Well, Brian does such a great job of summarizing the factors that are playing into the entitlement problems. So maybe I'll just give a little bit of kind of flavor to things. I focus mostly on Social Security. I do a little health care as well. But, I mean, Social Security is worth thinking about in the sense of just the size of it. I mean, it's the biggest federal government program. It's the biggest element of the federal budget. It's the biggest source of income for most retirees. It's also the biggest tax that most workers pay. And, you know, as Brian pointed out, Social Security is significantly underfunded going out over the long term. Medicare has all the same demographic problems as Social Security, plus it has the problem healthcare prices are rising. You know, the amount that we're spending on healthcare is rising. So we have more and more beneficiaries on whom we're spending more and more money, and we don't have enough new workers to really entering the system in order to keep things balanced. I've worked on Social Security for a long time. I was in the Bush White House working on it when he did Social Security reform. I worked in the Social Security Administration. Since that time, I've kind of taken the view that we need to step back with a lot of these programs and rethink how we're doing them. When a lot of people, you know, they call up their congressman or they write a letter to the editor of the newspaper about entitlements, they often do one of two things. They'll either say, hey, don't touch my benefits. I don't care whether you fix these programs or not. Don't touch my benefits. Or second, they'll kind of have a scapegoat of saying, well, everything would be fine if it just weren't for Congress spending the Social Security Trust Fund, or whether it's, you know, the disabled who are claiming too many benefits or something like that. And those are legitimate issues, but as Brian said, the real big problems, these sort of macro-level things where we have a much older population than we used to. And I think that means we should rethink how we do things in the sense of saying what do we want to accomplish with these programs? What are the things that individuals can do on their own? And I tend to think that it makes more sense for individuals to save more for retirement on their own, you know, if they're middle class, if they're upper income people, and try to focus the entitlement programs, you know, on the people who really need them the most. And in that way, I think we can still have an effective safety net while trying not to have that $30,000 payroll tax bill that Brian was talking about.
Great. Thank you. Operator, let's go ahead and open it up for questions.
Thank you. At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to be removed from the queue, simply press the pound key. Again, to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch-tone telephone. We'll pause momentarily to allow questions to queue. We'll take our first question from Tim Borchers. Please go ahead. Your line is open. Once again, Tim, your line is open. Please check your mute switch.
Hello? Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Excellent. I have a couple questions, and thank you for Policy Circle's work in coordinating this effort. One, I'm curious as to, have you looked at if you aged the eligibility for Social Security since we're living longer? I know the numbers in years past when Social Security started, the life expectancy was much lower. And so if you actually raised that significantly, what would that look like? And secondly, have we looked at, because of the skyrocketing cost of healthcare, especially for aging, you could be a very responsible person and saving for your retirement, but you get one illness that could basically blow your entire retirement savings out and you could actually be in poverty. Any thoughts on that?
And this is Andrew. If you'd like me to touch on the Social Security
sure.
issue, I'd be happy to. Well, yeah, it's one of the commonly suggested kind of solutions to Social Security funding problem is to increase the Social Security retirement age. Through most of the program's history, 65 was the age at which you could collect full Social Security benefits. You could still get early benefits reduced beginning at 62. Beginning in the year 2000, we started gradually shifting the retirement age from 65 up to 67. It'll reach 67 by the early 2020s. To give some context on the size of the Social Security funding problem, you know, we could continue increasing the Social Security retirement age from 67, you know, to go to 68, maybe up to 70 or so. That's still not going to be nearly enough to fix the long-term funding problem with the program. It's just it is a big funding gap that we're looking at. I do think that most people can work longer. We've seen, particularly in recent years, and even during the recession when the labor market for every other age group was really bad, that people who are retired or near retired have increased their labor force participation. They've actually had more jobs. They've been earning, you know, good wages. It's not all been, you know, the stereotypical Walmart greeter. So I think people can work longer, and it makes sense for them to do that because they get not just higher Social Security benefits, but they'll also be able to save more in their 401k and put aside more money for retirement. But still, you want to have options available, particularly for the disabled, for people who just physically can't work longer. So I think raising the retirement age makes sense, but it's something that we want to keep in context how much the problem is actually going to solve. Maybe I'll throw the healthcare question over to Brian, though.
Yeah, briefly, on the demographic issue, I will just briefly say that right now, if somebody who retires at 66 and lives to 90 will have spent one-third of their adult life in taxpayer-funded retirement. They will have worked for 48 years and retired for 24. That's just not sustainable for taxpayers to pay for one-third of your adult life. It's just not budgetarily sustainable. In terms of health care, I think one of the directions we want to move is to strengthen health coverage for catastrophic care. Think, you know, cancer, heart disease, heart attacks, serious injuries, but maybe pull back on having us overinsure routine care. You know, think of it when you have your car insurance. You have car insurance to save you from financial ruin in a major accident. You don't have car insurance to pay for your oil change. So I think one way to bring the cost of health care down would be to kind of emphasize it more for catastrophic care, but not so much for, you know, going and getting your flu shot or routine care.
Okay, do we want to take another question?
Great, thank you. And next we'll move to Kathy Hubbard. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes, I have a couple questions. What do you both think about the, there was a discussion in the past about Social Security savings accounts and, you know, healthcare savings accounts, and where people can save money and put it in and invest it themselves for their future and get tax write-offs for that. Where do you both stand on those concepts in terms of helping this problem, even if it's helping it part way, not the entire way?
Well, this is Andrew. I'll talk quickly about the Social Security side. I worked on the idea of the Social Security personal accounts for a very long time. I spent a year in the Bush White House when President Bush was pushing the idea. I strongly believe that people should have more savings outside of Social Security. I mean, you don't, given all that we've heard about the entitlement problems, you don't want to bet your retirement on the federal government coming through for you. So it makes sense for people to be saving more outside of Social Security. That said, at the time I originally started working on Social Security, it was running payroll tax surpluses. It was collecting more money through taxes than it needed to pay out in benefits. And one really useful idea for the personal accounts was that extra money, instead of basically being spent by the federal government on other stuff, could be put in these accounts so the Congress couldn't spend it and would set that money aside to help pay benefits in the future. And so I think, had we done that in the 1990s or even in the early 2000s, we would have had a lot of money set aside today, and that would have been really helpful. For a variety of reasons, that didn't happen. The issue we're facing today, though, is that Social Security is already running deficits. Since 2010, the amount of money we're paying in benefits has exceeded the amount of taxes that Social Security is collecting. Part of that was due to the recession that we had, but the biggest part was you have 10,000 baby boomers per day switching from being taxpayers paying into the system, people at the height of their careers, going into becoming beneficiaries, pulling money out of the system. So there's no more Social Security surpluses to save, which means you have to think about where the extra money to fund those accounts is going to come from. It's possible to work something up where you can build these accounts alongside Social Security, but I tend to think at this point the better route for that is just to encourage people to save more in 401ks by, say, making it easier for small businesses to offer 401ks, automatically signing people up for 401k, because a lot of times people forget to do it. I think that's a way of increasing savings for people for retirement with less sort of political fight involved.
Yeah, and I don't have much to add to Andrew. Health savings accounts are important to help us kind of move into a system I mentioned earlier where health insurance is catastrophic. We have modest health savings accounts that started in 2003, but really the way we're going to fix Medicare more broadly is with comprehensive changes, such as fewer subsidies in Medicare for the super rich, and maybe moving to a premium support system where instead of the government micromanaging your Medicare, you help pick out your own plan from the private sector, and then the government helps you pay for it. That introduces choice and competition into the system rather than having a one-size-fits-all government-run plan. I think those will make a difference. Even by themselves, they won't solve the entire Medicare problem because it's enormous. But those are some of the first steps we need to take.
Great. Let's take our next question.
Thank you. And next we'll move to Janet Burt. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi there. My question is on the entitlement side of the equation. Is there thoughts about any sort of system that would track those receiving the entitlements to make sure that they're not receiving benefits from more than one place, either on a local or a federal level? For example, in the state of Illinois, I know I'm involved in different charities in the northern part of the state where there are folks receiving entitlements from several different entities, and I'm wondering if there's any way to track that better so that everyone's receiving sort of equal entitlement across all different programs.
Part of that comes down.
I think so. I think, this is Andrew, I think you're referring not just to entitlements to Social Security and Medicare, but also to broader, you know, welfare programs. You'd have things like food stamps, TANF, housing benefits. There's a whole range of benefits like that. Now, in theory, either the state government or the federal government should be tracking those things. And I think they do a pretty reasonable job in the sense of knowing that if you're receiving a certain level of benefits, then if you start working, here's how, you know, your earnings affect your benefits and all that kind of stuff. You know, obviously you do get, you know, some fraud that's involved and stuff like that. I mean, there's no question about it. And there's some other things where, you know, what I might consider double dipping. I mean, for instance, you get people who are claiming disability benefits, you know, for which they have to tell the government they're physically unable to work, while at the same time they're claiming unemployment benefits, you know, for which they have to tell the government they are ready to work and out looking for a job. Now, you can't be both things at the same time, but currently legally you can do that. And there are some people in Congress who have some legislation to try to prevent that. But by and large, the government tracks this kind of stuff reasonably well. It's not always easy for an ordinary person to figure it all out from the data, but in theory, the government should have a decent grasp on that stuff.
Thank you.
Thank you, and next we'll move to Jasmine Hauser. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Kristen, you had mentioned something about illegal immigrants adding to the entitlement program, so I'm wondering if Brian or Andrew or you might have a figure on how that is further burdening our load.
I would just make one point there, and it can sound hard to differentiate, but I was saying legal immigrants, and so not illegal, but legal immigrants, and it does come in at different phases and different programs start at different times. So I don't know if Andrew or Brian would want to take that, but I just want to make sure I was clear talking about legal immigrants.
I've looked at it a fair bit on the Social Security side. The level of immigration plays into, you know, how Social Security's finances are kind of forecast going forward. Social Security's actuaries project that a higher level of legal immigration will generally have a small improvement finances. I'm a little skeptical of how they're producing the numbers. I think it's probably just about a wash there, that I just don't think it makes that much of a difference one way or the other. Illegal immigration is interesting in that most undocumented immigrants actually do pay payroll taxes. And that money goes into Social Security, but then obviously, you know, they can't show up at the Social Security office later to claim benefits. So undocumented immigrants tend to be a benefit to Social Security. But when you think about broader welfare programs, it gets very tricky in the sense that a lot of immigrants are not legally able to collect welfare benefits. But if they have children here, a lot of the benefits work through the children. You know, and the children, if they're born here, are American citizens. So it's, in that sense, it's conceptually a tough thing to get on top of. When you think of the big picture entitlements, your Social Security and Medicare, it's your aging and health care cost increases, those are the driving factors. Immigration might be a small positive, small negative, but I don't think that's going to determine how things play out.
Thanks. I have one other question. As far as the Social Security load to beneficiaries of, I think, Kristen, in your brief, you had mentioned that the last payout for a Civil War relative was paid out, I think, in 2002 or something. Would that help to lessen the burden to say, you know what, you're great, or I don't even know what a Social Security benefit would go to for a child? Does it stop it when they turn 18? Do they have it for, you know, how long? Would messing around with some of the eligibility help bring down, you know, the Social Security debt?
Again, this is Andrew. For something like kids' benefits, if you are if you're retired or you're disabled, it's more common with people who are disabled, and you have young children, you can collect benefits for the kids based on your kind of eligibility. Also, if you were to die, then a survivor's benefit could be paid to your kids. And that's, you know, that's an important sort of insurance element for Social Security. I think, if I remember the rules right, benefits are cut off for kids at age 18. I think they have to remain in school and even in order to get the benefits that far. I don't want to push the details too hard there. This is something I was just looking at recently, but now I've forgotten the details of it. In terms of eligibility, it's, you know, with Social Security, you have to work about 10 years in order to become eligible for benefits. So if you work 9 years, you may not be eligible for benefits at all. I think that's kind of a problem because, you know, those are folks who are going to be low income in retirement. I don't think you want to just cut people off from Social Security, but, you know, if you're somebody who earned, say, $100,000 every year of your life, you're going to receive a benefit from Social Security of about $32,000 per year. It does strike me that paying out $30,000 a year to somebody who basically doesn't need the money is not a particularly good use of the federal government's resources. I mean, that doesn't mean we should take some rich retiree today and just take away all his Social Security benefits. I mean, he paid in for them. He's entitled to them. But I think going forward, I personally think we want to transition away from a program that is paying high benefits to high-income people. I think that's just much more effectively done in the private sector. And that helps you trim down the size of these programs while still having a safety net for people.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take our next question from Danielle Mergener. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. So what I'm hearing you guys say is that due to the demographics, the graying of America, it's not really possible to tax our way or increase the working age out of this problem. So is it possible or even practical to structure incentives to have people use other investment vehicles and maybe legally allow them to opt out of Social Security and bring it back to what it was meant to be, which was sort of a rescue and a safety net for people who did need it, so that they might still access it in case of a catastrophic event like a health crisis?
I mean, I could talk about this, Xander, again. Or, Brian, do you want to take a shot at this? This might also be relevant in terms of health care.
To the extent that a lot of these are Social Security specific, I would rather you use your vast experience and expertise.
Well, when you come to, you do get these ideas of kind of opt out of Social Security, and I'll say in practice it's kind of hard, in the sense of the idea is we could give incentives to people. You know, we'll give you a tax break on, say, money you put into an IRA or 401k, but in exchange for that, you give up your Social Security benefits. Basically, people will generally not give up one benefit, say Social Security, unless the incentive they're getting from the government is worth more than what they're giving up. Which, you know, I mean, people will fudge around things a little bit, but meaning if you want to really buy people out of their Social Security benefits, it's going to cost a fair amount to do that. I tend to think that we need, I mean, you know, in theory, I like to have stuff that's kind of voluntary and based on incentives in that way. But the tough thing with something like Social Security, or even, you know, with Medicare as well, is that we're in this sort of zone where we've promised literally trillions of dollars more in benefits than we are willing to tax people to pay. You know, we've promised you one level of benefits, which is high, and another level of taxes, which is a lot lower. Resolving that in a voluntary way is often pretty tough to do because people say, I want all the benefits, but I don't want to pay the taxes for it. And that's something, I mean, this is just a broad observation. That's one way in which, you know, America is different from a place like Europe. If you go to Europe, they have very generous benefits, and you talk to Europeans, and they're generally like, well, I'm happy to pay the taxes for this. In the U.S., even with relatively progressive people, they want the benefits, they don't want to pay the taxes. So it's a tough thing to resolve in that sense. So I think partly government's just going to have to make some tough choices. And, you know, I think it's an important choice whether we decide to pay more for these benefits through higher taxes or whether we decide to get, you know, keep taxes where they are and get lower benefits. I personally think that's an important choice, because I think the taxes that are going to be charged are going to, you know, create disincentives to work and to save and to invest. I think the benefits themselves can cause those sorts of disincentives. I think for the people who have the ability to work longer, to save on their own, you know, meaning middle class, upper income people, you know, it's really better to hold the line on taxes as much as you can and then try to scale down the benefits where you need to do that.
To
others may feel differently. That's more or less where I am.
To piggyback on Andrew's point, two quick things. Number one, even if we gave people a great incentive to buy out of Social Security and Medicare, that's still going to that will save us money 30, 40 years down the road when they retire. But with all the baby boomers retiring today, if those people aren't paying payroll taxes, you're actually worsening the shortfall over the next 20 to 30 years because you're depriving the system of their revenue. So it's great that you save a lot of money in 40, 50 years, but, you know, in the long run, we're all dead if we don't get through the next few decades. And I'll add, too, just on the means testing point, that I think if you're going to pare back spending, even adjusted for people working longer, you don't want to hurt the most vulnerable. And so I think some sort of means testing is inevitable. And I don't mean cutting rich people off, but I'm saying maybe they shouldn't make as much of an advantage or receive come out as far ahead as they do currently, as many do in the system. And so I think you can very slightly start to slow the growth of benefits for, say, the top half or the top third in Social Security. And for Medicare, where people receive triple what they paid in, I think there's a lot of room to say, why are some of the wealthiest seniors receiving triple what they paid into the Medicare system? How does that serve the public interest?
Thank you, and we do have one time for one final question that comes from Deborah Pickett. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes. Kristen, I thought the brief on entitlements was excellent. And one of the questions that I had was, there was mention of Medicare and its price controls. And would you speak to, I'm not that familiar with how they operate, but where are those price controls sort of evident, and where would you like to see them reduced?
Sure. This is Brian. I can jump in on that. I mean, the way Medicare works is they set the prices for doctors and hospitals to pay for all of these procedures. And you have a huge bureaucracy. They set about 1 million prices a year. Really, the Soviet Union would be proud that we have the government setting 1 million prices. One of the ways in which Medicare keeps costs even lower than they would be otherwise is they often set the prices pretty low and sometimes even below cost. So what ends up happening is doctors and hospitals will take Medicare patients. They might actually take a loss on the Medicare patient, and then they raise the prices for other people outside of Medicare in order to recoup it. And the Democratic solution is just cut reimbursements even more. But if you cut them too much, at a certain point, doctors are just going to stop taking Medicare patients. So instead, my preference is to move out of the Soviet-style system of price controls and simply go to the premium support model where you say, look, you're going to have 12 or 15 insurance companies that are competing for your business. And when you pick the one you want, the government will give you a voucher at maybe the midpoint price of the 12 or 15. If you want a more expensive plan, you pay the difference. If you want a cheaper plan, you pocket the difference. But that way, when the insurance companies are competing for your business, they don't want to be the most expensive. Nobody wants to be the most expensive in the market. So the hope is that the way you reduce costs is by the industry itself becoming more efficient to compete for your business, rather than the government just saying, we're going to reimburse doctors less and less and less until they say the hell with it and drop out of the program. I don't think that model works.
Okay. Great. This is Selby. Thank you so much. Thank you guys for Andrew and Brian, Krista, and everyone on the call. The entitlement brief, as you know, is available in the brief library on the member-only Policy Circle website, and you can plan your next roundtable discussion on entitlements. One thing that I would ask everyone is when you discuss entitlements in your meeting, please post a recap of your meeting on your Circle page, and that's a way to capture your perspectives that were discussed, but also to give feedback on the briefs that we can improve, and we can also give your feedback to Brian and Andrew and Kristen. And, you know, a post after a meeting is a way to capture your voice. And the goal of having these roundtable discussion around an issue like entitlement is for us to really gain, like, thoughtful confidence in speaking up and participating in dialogue. So on this, I invite you to share the link to the entitlement brief with your congressman, congresswoman, and say that you're willing to have a conversation around this and share it with women that you know who are interested in starting a circle. So, thanks, everyone. Thank you, Brian and Andrew and Kristen. And have a great week. And we're planning on having these calls on a consistent basis. So we'll send to all the participants a quick survey to get your feedback so we can run these better. But I think it went really well. And thank you.